Good afternoon, everyone. I'm here to talk about FDA's response to a multi-state outbreak of Salmonella Bareilly and Salmonella Nanchanga associated with Nakaachi scrape tuna in 2012. And this was a very large outbreak of 425 cases in 28 states, resulting in 55 hospitalizations, and had an illness onset date range from January through July of 2012. So this is one of the larger outbreaks that CORE has been introduced with working on, and we'll talk a little bit about how that was handled based off of our new operating system. So as Mike was just asked, a little part of what FDA has done in order to improve FDA's response to ongoing outbreaks and responding to outbreaks is organized a group of folks called the Coordinated Outbreak Response and Evaluation Network. So I'm going to give a quick overview of that program, and then we'll get into talking about this particular investigation, the outbreak timeline, FDA's response to the outbreak, the traceback investigation, a little bit of background about what a traceback investigation is and what this particular investigation showed us. The trace forward investigation, sampling of regulatory samples, work with the firm to recall the product, as well as the international inspection. So CORE was officially launched in August 1st of 2011, so we're just beyond our 1 year anniversary. The mission of CORE is to address illnesses due to FDA regulated human and animal food, as well as cosmetics. The goal is to streamline incident-related processes and enhance transparency. And again, we do have information posted on the web about CORE specifically. So CORE is mainly composed of three teams, and each teams are composed of dedicated multidisciplinary cadre of FDA personnel, some with prior outbreak investigation experience, and some of us with other experience. For example, I'm a microbiologist that serves on one of the CORE teams. So we start with our signals and surveillance team, and this is the team that's going to perform early signal detection and monitoring. This group works closely with our partners in the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as with local and state health officials to identify any particular clusters of illnesses that seem to be appearing that might be related to an FDA-regulated product. Once an outbreak crosses a certain threshold or reaches some identified criteria by the signals and surveillance team, it's then transferred to a response team, which of course has three different response teams. And this is to organize rapid and coordinated response associated with foodborne illness outbreaks. So the response teams are largely responsible for orchestrating the traceback investigations, sampling assignments, doing everything that we can to identify whatever the product is that is contaminated and help get it off the marketplace. And finally, one of the most interesting aspects of CORE is the addition of a post-response team. And this is a team of dedicated staff that's after an outbreak response is over, after we're not seeing any more ill cases, after product is being withdrawn from the market, we don't want to see all of that evidence and all of the information that was collected in that investigation fall by the wayside. So a post-response team has been dedicated to formulate work groups that can either discuss whether an environmental assessment is necessary, and in the Listeria monocytogenes outbreak in cantaloupe last year, an environmental assessment was performed, which was very helpful to that industry. They also address issues of process improvement, inform agency policy, and inform industry regarding best practices. So the overall goal of the post-response team is to take these lessons learned from what we're seeing in these outbreaks to prevent future outbreaks. This is just a diagram of our current organizational structure. We're led by a chief medical officer whose name is Dr. Kathleen Gensheimer, And we also have an acting deputy director and Admiral Brenda Holman. We're led by, we're split into two branches, the prevention branch and the response branch. The prevention managers, actually, Don Cowder left us, so we actually have an acting manager in his place right now. And underneath the prevention branch is where our signals team and our post-response team are located. We also have a response branch, which is composed of, again, the three response teams. And something that's also been unique to CORE is having dedicated communication specialists work with both sides, both branches, so that we can get public messaging out about outbreaks as soon as possible. So to talk now about this specific outbreak, again, following CORE's organizational structure, our CORE signals and surveillance team was the first team that was alerted to a small cluster of Salmonella Borrelli illnesses in New York, and this information was identified in PulseNet, which is CDC's database of pulse field gel electrophoresis patterns that compare different strains of Salmonella. At this particular time, the vehicle was unknown, but the pattern, this PFGE pattern that was being seen, was very rare and was also occurring in five other states. So one of the strengths of having a database like PulseNet is CDC and FDA are both able to go back and look at the historical laboratory information that we've seen in this pattern before. Has it been associated with cases in the United States? How often? Have we, in any food samples that have been collected in years past, have we seen this organism? Have we seen this particular pattern? And one thing that was noticed right away is that this pattern previously had been associated with different types of seafood. So on March 6th, there was a potential association with seafood, and some of the cases were also reporting consumption of seafood. So CDC deployed a hypothesis-generating questionnaire for states and local health officials to use when questioning cases about what foods they were exposed to 7 days prior to illness. By March 15th, as more cases appeared to be coming in, the event was transferred to one of our CORE response teams. And this effort for some time was led by Tracy Duvernoy over at CORE. And at this point in time, the vehicle was still unconfirmed, but the epidemiology that was coming in indicated that 80% of all cases did have a seafood exposure, with 55% reporting sushi exposure. We began to bring in our subject matter experts from CIFSAN. We have our seafood experts over there. And one of the things we discussed with them was we started to look at the geographical disparity of the cases. So as you can see, this was a map that was put together by the CDC on March 16th. And we were noticing that there were a lot of cases clustered on the East Coast, but nothing west of Texas. So our seafood experts have a lot of information about how seafood moves across the United States. So would this likely be a fresh supplier of seafood or a frozen supplier of seafood? We'd be looking at an imported product or a domestic product. So those are all types of information we began thinking about very early on. And of course, as this type of data review is ongoing, we also wait for more epidemiological information to come in from the states and CDC. And the states began to focus their efforts on collecting information from cases that ate at a single restaurant. So those would be our restaurant clusters. It also, as sushi became to be more commonly reported, we began to ask for more specific information about sushi. So what type of sushi? And that's when spicy tuna rolls started to come in the picture. And of course, as you know, sushi is what we call a complex food. It's composed of mixed ingredients. So at this point in time, while we're thinking seafood based off of our historical PFGE evidence, we see different patterns of Salmonella pop up in all kinds of different vehicles that were never previously historically associated, so it was always important that we kept all of those ingredients in mind. And we also began to review import data. Because of the large geographical distribution of cases, it did seem to appear more likely that this was a frozen imported product. However, fresh domestic product was always on our radar. And the states were also out collecting samples at the restaurants they were visiting. So the response team was also evaluating those results. And at that point in time, everything that was coming in was negative. So as the number of cases began to increase, we still had not identified a vehicle. And the more people that we realized were needed to coordinate this type of incident that was becoming so large scale, on April 2nd, an incident management group was mobilized to address the incident and address those surge capacity issues. And the incident management group actually meets here at FDA's Emergency Operations Center and had a group of approximately 30 staff dedicated to work on this outbreak for an extended period of time. So one of the first things, and again, as the outbreak was ongoing, all of this information was being collected. Information coming in from restaurant clusters doesn't happen easily and it doesn't happen overnight. So the states were out working very hard to collect information about what the cases were consuming and what the restaurants were utilizing. So before we could begin tracing any of the products that might be in common to the cases, we first needed to discuss or investigate what ingredient we should be looking at. So again, as the states went out and collected all of the information, they reported back to us what some of the restaurants were using and what ingredients were going into the spicy tuna rolls that seemed to be indicated in the epidemiological information. And some of the common ingredients in this instance included mayonnaise, sesame seeds, tuna, both fresh and frozen, hot sauce, seaweed, and rice. Those seemed to be the common ingredients across the board that were going into the spicy tuna rolls. So one of the first things that we did is we compared the brand names and manufacturers of the products that were being used. And that general comparison excluded mayonnaise, rice, seaweed, and sesame seeds. We didn't see any commonalities within those ingredients among all of the restaurants that we were looking at. And so this left two commodities for FDA to investigate, meaning the tuna, both fresh and frozen, because we had reports of restaurants using both types. And then finally, hot sauce. But the hot sauce we kind of took as a secondary approach because the hot sauce we knew was nationally distributed. And again, when we were looking at our map of where cases where people were getting sick, we weren't seeing any cases west of Texas. So it didn't seem likely that this was a nationally distributed product. So based off of that information, we initiated a traceback investigation on fresh and frozen tuna supplied to our restaurant clusters. So what a traceback investigation is performed to identify and document where product came from. It does require a large number of state and federal resources to collect records of product shipments and deliveries. So, for example, when FDA goes to a distribution center to perform this type of record collection, not only do they have to say, we're interested in your records from this date period that went to this specific location, they also need to verify that information, look for situations of commingling of product, multiple brands that might have gone into a single shipment, see if they can get any information about lot information, as well as look for some of the common practices utilized by these distribution centers that they're visiting. The traceback investigation does start at multiple points of service where several ill consumers were composed to a product. And again, that's our definition of a cluster. And finally, the whole goal is to identify common sources of the product being traced. So now that we had a common product to trace, we were looking for a common source of that product. One of the factors that can really lead to a successful traceback investigation is being very choosy with your clusters. So at this point in time, we did have a lot of cases coming in. We had a lot of single cases coming in. So when I say that, I mean one person was reported being ill at a single restaurant, but there weren't a cluster of cases at that restaurant. So with that being said, we were also getting reports of multiple restaurant clusters. So what FDA had to do was identify the best restaurant clusters to trace, which cases did we know were going to be the strongest to trace because they had great epidemiology, we could get great records, etc. So we identified 7 criteria in order to determine the best clusters, one being that there was a common product consumed by cases. So did everybody in that restaurant cluster eat something with raw tuna in it? Was it raw ground tuna? Was it raw fresh tuna? Was it raw frozen tuna, etc.? We also preferred restaurants that had where cases had confirmed exposure dates at a single restaurant rather than having cases that ate sushi at restaurant A, B, or C on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, which with some sushi eaters for lunch, that's what they like to go out and do. We were also looking for the availability of a complete list of the meal items that were consumed. So if a case reported that they had spicy tuna, that was great, but we also wanted to make sure we had information about all of the other meal items they were consuming as well. We wanted to select clusters where we had early access to shipment records. Because again, as this is ongoing, some of the states were very proactive about collecting records at these facilities. So we were able to move a little bit faster on investigating those clusters. At this point in time, we were also looking for the preference of use of shelf-stable ingredients. The timeline of the outbreak in our epi curve, we noticed that the cases weren't in a very short period of time like we'd see if it was a fresh commodity that was on the shelf, expended its shelf life, no longer available to consumers, and we saw a decrease in cases. What happened in this outbreak is it expanded a very long period of time, which was leading us to believe that likely a fresh tuna product couldn't cause an outbreak like this. This was likely something that was shelf stable, like a frozen product. We also wanted to identify clusters with frequent or regular shipments to the venue because we were dealing with some frozen product. Some of these points of service were only getting one shipment of tuna every 6 months. So in order for us to really better determine the shipment and handling practices at these points of service, we were looking more for venues that had that were receiving regular shipments. And finally, we wanted to select clusters that aided the geographical distribution of the outbreak. So we had a lot of cases clustered in the Northeast, but we also had cases in Texas. So it was important to also identify clusters that met that type of geographical distribution. So reviewing all of the information and ranking these clusters, and again, no one cluster met all 7 criteria, but we did have each one of these clusters were very strong. So we selected restaurants in Connecticut, Texas, Wisconsin, and Rhode Island. So we also were covering the geographic distribution as well. So for this particular traceback investigation, it took 18 traceback assignments that were issued to 6 FDA district offices over the course of 3 days. And again, as I said, a traceback assignment isn't something that takes an investigator an hour to do. These can take a single day, or these can take multiple days, depending on the amount of records, how good the records are kept at these distribution centers, which, as we know, is not always the case. So it was a very large effort on FDA's part to initiate this traceback. The FDA IMG analytical group staff, which is where I was a part of, performed the intensive record review of the thousands of documents that came in for each one of these restaurant clusters. And from reviewing these documents, we were able to draft traceback diagrams and timelines that could map the product distribution chains. So it's hopefully a little bit more clear on the big screen, but to the left on this diagram, you can see our four restaurant clusters. So we have our Connecticut, Texas, Wisconsin, and Rhode Island clusters. And this is a very simplified diagram of what we were looking at, because each one of these clusters had their own very intensive traceback investigation where we were looking at single shipments. But as far as the summary is concerned, you can see that each one of these restaurants were working with multiple distribution centers who were also supplied by multiple distribution centers who were also supplied by multiple suppliers. So the likelihood of seeing convergence in something like this, unless it's really factual and really telling, is small. What I do want to draw your attention to are the boxes that are highlighted in red. So you'll notice the first one in to the right of the diagram, we did find a common supplier of fresh seafood. So this was a fresh tuna supplier located in Louisiana. And this was a very small domestic operation. And it was our first point of convergence that we saw. And as you can see with all of these firms, you know, you get excited about any kind of convergence between legs. But the more we learned about this particular facility, the more we realized there's no way they were producing enough product that could have supplied all of these cases. So it seemed very unlikely, and again, none of the other cases or none of our other restaurant clusters led to convergence at this particular supplier. Well, you'll see all of the convergence for our four legs are the red boxes that are at the bottom of the diagram. This is the common importer of the product, which was Moon Marine Fisheries, and this was the exporter of the product located in India and supplier of the product, Moon Fishery in India. Those are the points where we saw convergence of all four points of service. If you look to above and below, we have our common distribution centers that distributed that product to the cases. But again, all four converged on this Moon Fishery location in India. And this was, as we learned, supplied fresh Nakaachi scrape to each of these points of service. So some of the challenges with performing a traceback investigation, basically it all starts at the local level. So when we're talking and state and local officials are out interviewing folks that work at these restaurants and trying to get information about the products that are being used, it's noted first that every sushi supplier wants to say that they're using fresh tuna. And no matter who they're talking to, they want to tell them, we are using fresh tuna. We don't use any frozen tuna product here. So we really had a lot of conflicting reports with what was being documented by investigators based off of what someone said versus what we were seeing on the records. Also, a lot of points of service were cash and carry customers. And this causes obviously a lot of complications because there are no records that need to be associated with that kind of product exchange. Also, on the records themselves, there were no identifying factors like lot codes or production dates. By the time we trace back to a single source, to communicate with that source about what product could be affected gets very complicated without having that information. And a lot of times, certain distribution centers tie their own lot codes to products. And one thing we found in this particular situation is that the boxes themselves had a production date label, but they were assigned so many different lot numbers that there was no way to make the association of lot numbers with production dates, because each lot code had multiple production dates associated. Finally, there was improper product invoicing at the distribution level. Early on, a lot of people thought the source of this might be Indonesian tuna, because from some of the records on the invoices, it was noted country of origin, Indonesia. But then as you follow that product back, you realize, Well, that's just a standard invoicing queue that's being utilized in their computer system, and it doesn't match what's stamped on the product. So that was an issue at a couple of distribution centers as well. Also, there was a change in product description at each location on the records. So while on the box it says Nakaachi Scrape, when a lot of these points of service were receiving the product, they weren't looking at the box. They looked inside, saw what looked like frozen ground tuna that they would typically get from an invoice that said frozen ground tuna. So as we kept going back in the distribution chain, the records were reading frozen ground tuna, and then all of a sudden we get to a point where it's designated as Nakaachi Scrape. And I didn't know anything about tuna before this investigation, so it wasn't until our subject matter experts informed us what that product was versus ground tuna that we noticed that was definitely conflicting labeling on that type of on those type of documents. And then finally, there was also a lack of product labeling. The actual boxes were labeled, but the individual packets of the tuna were not labeled. And this really was probably more problematic for the folks that were doing recall effectiveness, because there was no way for points of service to tell if they still had that product on hand if they pulled those packets out and just had them sitting in their freezer. So after we had identified a common supplier of the tuna product, the next thing to do was identify where all of this contaminated product could have gone, and is anything available to sample. So 23 trace forward and sampling assignments were issued to 9 FDA district offices, and these were some of the points of service that were identified by the efforts of those investigations. And again, where we tried to focus our sampling efforts were on these distribution centers that you can see that came from the warehouse that was storing the product. And again, this does not cover the entire distribution of what we saw for that product. This is just what could fit nicely on a diagram. But one thing I do want to note is all of the restaurants that you see here that were identified in this, these were all restaurants that had at least one ill person consume at them. So on top of the success of the traceback investigation, what the trace forward was telling us was that many of these, we knew we were looking at the right product because many of these restaurants could be directly linked to the product itself. And again, the traceback investigation identified the Moon Fishery product at 20 points of service where clinical cases reported exposure. The sampling efforts based off of that yielded 7 samples that contained both Salmonella Borreli and Salmonella Nchanga. And I should mention that about a week before while we were waiting for the sample results. So the sample results took about 5 to 7 days to be completed, especially with PFGE. We were notified by CDC of a small cluster of the Salmonella Nchanga cases that the ill persons were also reporting spicy tuna exposure. So you can imagine how elated we were and how excited we were to sort of get the smoking done for both of these outbreaks in one sample, because the first positive sample that came in was positive for both serotypes. 7 samples also yielded either Salmonella Borreli or Salmonella Nchanga. And again, the pulse field gel electrophoresis patterns were indistinguishable from both of the patterns that were identified by those clusters. So based off of that information, FDA did place the firm on import alerts 16-81 and 16-133. A voluntary recall was done by Moon Fishery based off of the traceback investigation alone. So this firm was very proactive with recalling their product, not waiting for sample results. Once we saw them as a common supplier, they weighed heavily on that evidence and took it very seriously. So we were very happy to see how quickly they recalled the product. Now, on May 9th, tuna strips that were being imported from Moon Fishery were collected because of the import alert, so this is product that never entered commerce. They tested positive, and the firm also performed a recall of those particular products. While the IMG was still stood up, a international inspection at Moon Fishery in India was also orchestrated and arranged, and we worked with our international office in India to make that happen. The inspection lasted 5 days, but unfortunately, the entire time the inspection team was there, they were not able to witness processing because of a countrywide fishing ban that was going on in India at the time. But even still, they performed a general HACCP inspection and issued a 483 that contained critical control point and sanitation issues that were cited. And the redacted version of that 483 is available on the FDA website. So in conclusion, based off of the EpiData trace back, trace forward efforts, as well as the laboratory findings, the source of this outbreak was identified as Nakaachi scraped tuna from Moon Fishery. Ongoing investigations are needed to really identify the root cause of the contamination, so why this product became contaminated. Recall audit checks were conducted, and as I said before, because of the lack of product labeling, it was a very, very difficult process, and a lot of the reason why after the recall we still saw cases being reported. And finally, FDA's efforts are still ongoing. We're working with our folks in the Office of Regulatory Science here at CIFSAN on sequencing a lot of these isolates to get doing whole genome sequencing on those isolates to get an understanding about the origin and seeing how each one of the clusters relates to one another, which has been really interesting data for them to show us. And the firm's corrective measures will be reviewed by FDA because, again, the 483 was issued. So they did perform some corrective measures, and we'll work with our India office to accomplish that. So some long-term goals, and again, these are recommendations that would be made to our post-response team, along with focusing on that particular commodity. FDA does want to work to improve FDA policies that directly affect product traceability. As you could see, there were a lot of challenges here that maybe the investigation could have moved forward even more quickly than it had, had product traceability been a little bit easier. We need to continue to implement processes that ensure safety of imported foods. As more foods become imported in this country, that's certainly something that's of importance. And finally, to evaluate more efficient communication strategies for information sharing with both stakeholders and the public. As these investigations are ongoing, you can imagine they move very rapidly, and there's a lot of information that's even within a system like the IMG that moves very quickly. So we also need to make sure that we're communicating as much information as we can as quickly as possible, and that process is always improving. And again, you can visit the FDA or CDC web postings for more information. And those are my acknowledgments, so thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. That was really interesting. I was wondering, in the beginning you talked about how you first start kind of tracking. I think you said it was SST. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about the criteria for how many illnesses it takes to start kind of tracking something? Or is it because it's in multiple states? Maybe talk a little bit about that criteria. And then also, I don't know if you gleaned any consumer advice from this. I don't know if you eat sushi, but I think the part when you were talking about how it's not labeled at the point of service is kind of hard. Like, if I'm eating at a sushi restaurant, what kind of questions might I ask, to see if they knew where their fish even came from?
Okay. First, to address your question about the criteria, it's not necessarily just a case count number. Outbreaks differ greatly on the geographic disparity of the cases. So multi-state outbreaks become very difficult to coordinate by, just one person that's evaluating an outbreak. Also, depending on the organism, the number of hospitalizations, have there been any deaths associated? All of that is really important information. And I know our signals team could probably list to you 5 or 6 other criteria, but that they also utilize. Most importantly, when it comes to thinking about ill cases, when an outbreak is within a state and is being heavily coordinated by that state, we are always reaching out to the state, wanting to know, is it an FDA regulated product that could be in interstate commerce, and working with them to stay up to date on that information. As far as eating sushi, one thing that was interesting, and I gave this presentation at the International Association for Food Protection, and spoke with some of the folks in industry there, and one thing that they mentioned is that this Nakaachi scrape product is not something that's typically utilized by suppliers to supply tuna for raw consumption. And typically, what you eat at a sushi restaurant would be a frozen tuna loin that has the ends cut off and then is ground. So that type of processing, I'm sure, is a lot different than the processing of Nakaachi scrape, and perhaps that's why, for example, this particular product has a higher risk factor than that other type. So I guess one thing that you could ask is, are you using ground tuna product or Nakaachi scrape? But again, apparently it's not something that's used heavily in the industry. So.
Hi there.
Hi.
We learned a little bit yesterday about the fact that they may be using these genetic ID techniques to try to sort of identify where some of these things may be in worldwide. So I'm just wondering if the science is there yet for you to be able to, if you do have a sample of the sushi that has this bacteria in it, that you could, sort of say, oh, well, clearly it came from India because we can tell from the genetic imprint.
Yeah, it would be really nice to cut back all that record review, wouldn't it? I think right now the technology needs database building before we could really utilize it in that capacity. So that's one of the reasons why we are so actively engaged with our Office of Regulatory Sciences. They're interested in getting their hands on isolates that come out of outbreaks like this so that they can build their libraries of all of these different strains and serotypes of a variety of pathogens so that perhaps in the future we can move in that direction. Because as you can see, this was an example of a very successful traceback investigation, and unfortunately, we're not always that lucky to be able to identify a source like we did in this instance. But is the technology there today to do that? Are the databases there today? No, but I know part of the 100,000 genome product is to work on building those libraries and having as much access as we can to with that type of information.